This podcast of The Exchange is sponsored by
Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
And Doucet Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
Enjoy the show.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Brady Carlson in for Laura Canoy, and this is The Exchange. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. Vice President Joe Biden was in New Hampshire this week to receive UNH Law School's Warren Rudman Award for Public Service. In his acceptance speech, he called for more policies to help the middle class.
It's all we have to do, folks. Just give the middle class a fighting chance. It's not hyperbole. It's not a political. It's just a fact. When the middle class does well, everybody does well.
Meanwhile, the debate over a new natural gas pipeline continues. Speaking with NHPR this week, New Hampshire Republican Majority Leader in the State House, Jack Flanagan, laid out his argument against a new pipeline.
Let's not disrupt 17 communities with eminent domain or access roads or pumping stations and blasting and construction and the environmental impact that I've been reading about, too. Let's just take an existing pipeline and make it bigger.
It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange, and let's hear from you. Call in. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. You can email us, exchange@nhpr.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our guest this week, Kevin Landergan, Chief Political Correspondent for New Hampshire One News. Great to see you, Kevin.
Thanks, Brady. Good to be on with you.
And Josh Rogers, NHPR Senior Political Reporter. Welcome back to you as well, Josh.
Good morning, Brady.
Well, let's start with the news of some big national political figures coming in. Of course, it's always notable, Kevin, when a vice president comes to New Hampshire, but particularly so when that vice president says he's considering a run for the White House and that he's also been traveling to Iowa and South Carolina. Tell us a little bit about Joe Biden's trip to New Hampshire this week.
Yeah, it was really interesting because throughout the trip, you're asking the question, is this an Obama victory lap or is this really a testing the waters presidential campaign? There's no doubt in my mind, at least, having spent a day with him and many times before, this guy wants to run for president again. It would be a third time. But he's got a major obstacle in front of him. That would be Hillary Clinton, the obvious Democratic frontrunner and the one the party establishment has already decided. Many national figures in the party have moved on beyond Biden. Biden sort of is looking for that window of opportunity for him to jump into this presidential campaign, but it's kind of reminiscent of Dan Quayle when he was vice president under George H. Bush. Not enough people in the party, elders in the party, saw Dan Quayle as the heir apparent, much as they saw the elder Bush, the heir apparent to Ronald Reagan. That's the struggle that Biden faces. But he continues to put himself in very good position in the unlikely event that Hillary Clinton decides she's either too old or not well enough to run for president.
And Josh, you spent part of the day with Vice President Biden as well. And that same question that Kevin asked, is this the vice president speaking in his official capacity about Obama administration policies, or is this a potential 2016 candidate starting to test those waters once again in New Hampshire? What did you hear when you saw him speak?
Well, I certainly heard a spirited and lengthy at the Rudman Center a speech about, you know, ticking through Obama administration economic policies that the vice president defended and said is, you know, put the country in a good place. You know, he also reveled in being sort of a raconteur of the U.S. Senate when talking about Warren Rudman and how things have changed. And, you know, he had some interesting anecdotes about giving the eulogy at Strom Thurmond's funeral, for instance, and attending the funeral of Jesse Helms. And he was talking about those fellows in the context of, you know, getting along with people with whom you have ideological disagreements, and that's something that's increasingly a problem. A law student stood up and asked him, you know, for advice for somebody who's going to public service. And he said, well, you know, it's certainly fine to question somebody's logic, to question somebody's argument. But, you know, too much these days, people are immediately questioning somebody's motive, and that is, you know, poisonous in his estimation. As for, you know, his political future, you know, I agree with Kevin that he certainly looks as if he's interested in running, but faces steep challenges. You know, he's run twice before. He didn't exactly light it up either times. It's a little different running as a vice president. But, you know, when he for better or for worse, and whether this is a caricature or fact, you know, the way in which Joe Biden is perceived now is not as Joe Biden foreign policy expert or Joe Biden seasoned Senate hand. It's often, you know, Joe Biden sort of comic figure and Joe
the
Biden
off-the-cuff
character.
Speaker, yeah.
And he would face a steep challenge. But if Hillary Clinton decides not to run, you know, there are not that many people who are really, you know, sticking their toes in, who history would suggest would have a great deal of success in uniting all aspects of the party. Joe Biden could connect with a key part of the Democratic electorate, and certainly some voter, you know. So, you know, we'll see. He certainly was very coy. I mean, he more or less declined to answer any questions about this when he was here. And he said in the past he would decide in the summertime. And, you know, it's almost March.
So still some time to go. But it is worth also noting, Kevin, that so far, at least, we haven't heard any news other than these trips of Biden putting together any kind of campaign organization. He's not hiring staff that we've heard of. He doesn't have a political action committee that might try to back a presidential run, whereas we have heard that about Hillary Clinton, for example.
Yeah, we have. And certainly, I think Biden has enough contacts and enough credits, if you will, in the Beltway to be able to build an organization, like I said, particularly if Hillary Clinton did not run. I did a piece earlier this week because what I find fascinating about all this, frankly, is what does the loyal opposition do with this guy? You know, in other words, if you're in the Republican establishment, if you're working for any of these wannabes for 2016, do you want Joe Biden to run against Hillary Clinton? Will he? He likely will not beat her. I don't think could beat her, but could present some problems. Do you instead make him the devil incarnate of President Obama, who, by the way, hasn't been in New Hampshire since 2012 and probably won't come here before he leaves office in the end of 2016. Do you make him the object of ridicule, like Josh alluded to? A person, you know, Senator Marco Rubio, we'll talk about later in the program, one of the colorful comments he made was basically, you know, if I made one comment that Joe Biden makes almost every day, my career would be over. Biden's been in this game more than 50 years in one form or another. He's not going to invent any new moves. So if you're a handler of Joe Biden, you put up with the colorful anecdotes that Josh alluded to, including those that really even make some of his friends wince, like he refers to the arch-conservative Koch brothers as really good guys. I mean, he's trying too hard, as Josh pointed out, to point out that even these people you disagree with greatly may be fine human beings. Well, to liberals, the Koch brothers are not fine human beings.
And that question of whether a contested primary on the other party's side, Josh, is always a question because it can cut both ways. You can hope that the other party's candidates will tear each other apart in the primary process and make them more vulnerable in the general election. And then it may turn out that they wind up with a better general election candidate, but it can also work the other way as well. We've seen both here.
I mean, certainly Republicans are sensitive to the former possibility and have tried to, you know, arrange their schedule and perhaps have fewer debates and have an earlier convention so as there's more time to sort of get behind the nominee and less time beating each other up. You know, certainly culturally, Democrats, you know, particularly here in New Hampshire, perhaps are very comfortable without contested primaries. This is something that, you know, may have been a survival tactic during lean years in the past, but, you know, times are a bit fatter for Democrats these days here. But the general MO of, like, let's just keep the fighting in the back room, you know, persist. But, you know, presidential, it's a different thing. You know, it's hard to see nobody running. But, you know, there's a clip when Democratic Party Chair Ray Buckley was on Hardball on MSNBC that, you know, Republicans were making fun of was when, you know, he was asked by Chris Matthews, the host, so would you like to have a debate, you know, I'm paraphrasing, in New Hampshire? And, you know, Chairman Buckley was very much on message, like, you know, if credible candidates emerge, you know, the idea that people be – the Democratic establishment, particularly in New Hampshire perhaps, but certainly across the country, the Clintons are very powerful. They're quite comfortable getting behind her. There are certainly elements within the party that don't like the Clintons, but certainly in New Hampshire, you don't hear much from them.
Today on The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. Political heavyweights such as Vice President Joe Biden and Florida U.S. Senator Marco Rubio have come to the Granite State. Anthem has revealed that more than 600,000 New Hampshire customers were affected by the recent data hack, and the Associated Press has explored the impact of declining federal funding for the state's roads. Those stories and more are part of our discussion today, and we hope you'll join the discussion as well at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or at exchange@nhpr.org. Kevin, you mentioned Marco Rubio a little while ago, and he has maybe not been in the Granite State as many times as Joe Biden, but he has been here. He was here during the midterm elections, and he was here this week and was very forthright that, yes, he is thinking that he might come back as a potential presidential candidate in the 2016 campaign.
Yeah, so he's hired one of the smarter political operatives, too, in New Hampshire to run his campaign, Jim Merrill, who is at this point not a campaign, but rather the Northeast PAC. Jim Merrill was one of the architects of Mitt Romney's two presidential runs in New Hampshire and, of course, his win in 2012. You can't do much better than him. Rubio's kind of an interesting character. He's got a great personal story and a proven vote getter in Florida in a state where often conservative Republicans have difficulty winning statewide.
And so, makes a big difference in presidential electoral politics,
it
too.
It does. And Florida is a very important state. Certainly in every presidential election, if the Republican nominee can win Florida, ask George W. Bush how important that can be. But Rubio's certainly going to have his share of challenges. His desire to form consensus on immigration reform landed him probably his biggest signature victory. He was able to pass through the Senate, a very divided Senate, immigration reform. But conservatives on the right, very unhappy with that proposal. There'll be conservatives in this state that will give him a hard time on it. He got questions about it during his visit here. I think it'll be an even bigger problem, frankly, in Iowa, the home of the first state caucus, because so many jobs in New Iowa are taken by illegal aliens that Iowa workers won't accept. That phenomenon isn't as great here.
And we'll continue to talk about Senator Rubio's visit to New Hampshire and the issue of immigration as it played out on his visit to the state this week after a short break. This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. This is The Exchange. I'm Brady Carlson. Today in The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. We're covering some of the top stories that made headlines this week. Call in at 1-800-892-6477 or send an email to exchange@nhpr.org. You can also find us on Facebook or Twitter. With us this hour is Josh Rogers, NHPR senior political reporter, and Kevin Landrigan, chief political correspondent for New Hampshire One News. Just before the break, we were talking about Florida U.S. Senator Marco Rubio, and one of the issues, Josh, that came up in his visit this week was immigration. He got questioned by a member of the audience, and we have some sound now of his response to those questions.
I don't think anyone can commit that to you. You have 12 million human beings in America, most of whom we don't even know who they are, and some of whom our country's not going to tolerate rounding up and sending back. That's not a realistic proposal. I will tell you what I'll commit to. The first thing I'll commit to is the one thing we should be doing right now, and that's creating systems to be able to enforce our immigration laws that we don't have in place today.
That's Florida U.S. Senator Marco Rubio speaking this week in New Hampshire to a question from an audience member about whether he would deport all people in the country illegally if he were elected president. And Josh, this is, as Kevin said, probably an issue that's going to come up on the campaign trail if he decides to join the fray.
Well, it was interesting because obviously he doesn't really have much of a choice but to stand his ground. I mean, this was his piece of legislation that, you know, Gang of Eight supported by New Hampshire's two senators, by the way, got through the Senate, stalled in the House. Certainly immigration is something that Republican primary voters are keying in on. It was interesting to hear him go on to talk about Department of Homeland Security funding, and he made a big point about saying that he did not want a so-called clean bill where that could be where Homeland Security funding would be a standalone measure, which is, you know, what the Democrats want and seemingly where we may be headed. But that he was happy to tie in something that would undo the president's action, executive action on immigration. And, you know, he pitched this more as a separation of powers issue and that looking to rein in executive overreach. But, you know, he was pretty forceful on that point, and there were heads nodding in the audience. I mean, Rubio, he is very skilled in a retail politics situation. He's very comfortable in front of a crowd. You know, he has an easy manner, and, you know, he cuts an interesting profile. I was talking to one, you know, fairly well-traveled Republican after the event, and he said, you know, he certainly wouldn't be ready to commit, but he liked what he saw on Rubio. He said, you know, he helps us turn the page. And, you know, whether a lot of Republicans feel that that's what they need to do, and to get back to what Kevin alluded to, it's one thing coming out of Florida that's helpful, unless there's also another guy coming out of Florida named Jeb Bush. And that's the question that's been hanging over Rubio nationally. And when he was asked about that, he's been joking about, oh, no one's ever asked me about this before. And, you know, he said he's going to wait. And there's also going to be some pressure on him to run again for the Senate. He'll be up. And so that's going to be a choice he's going to have to make. And, you know, he is only 43 years old, so there may be time for him. But, you know, these things are hard to call. But certainly he has the attributes that could make for an appealing candidate in New Hampshire. He's easy with people. He's comfortable in the crowd. He will talk. He will take any question. That sort of thing is all something that he's quite comfortable doing.
And Kevin, he said that if he does decide to run for president, he would try to do a lot of town hall style, the retail politics events that sometimes top tier candidates have not done as many of in recent primaries.
Yeah, when he was a legislative leader in Florida, he was a shy figure, but not outwardly outgoing. I think he was really helped by going back to school. And by that, I mean he actually became a college lecturer at Florida International University, and he still teaches there now even while he's in the Senate. And I think that helps him a great deal, to Josh's point. He's much more comfortable talking about himself and talking about his views. And he defends him pretty well. And I think in this very crowded primary, where there are going to be a lot of sharp elbows, I think the candidate who can – kind of weave through this maze and win the nomination is going to have to be somebody who not only plays offense well against the Democrats, but plays very good defense.
This is the Exchange New Hampshire Friday News Roundup, and we hope you'll join us at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or email exchange@nhpr.org. Josh, one of the candidates getting a lot of – or potential candidates, I should say, getting a lot of attention at the end of the week is neither Joe Biden nor Marco Rubio, but a well-known television personality, businessman, and a perennial voice that comes up as we approach an election year, Donald Trump. And he's now making those murmurs again about how he may try – to go for the Republican nomination.
Indeed. You know, he's hired Corey Lewandowski, who's well-known in New Hampshire political circles, a GOP operative. And, you know, Corey's got a bit of a showman in him as well. And so perhaps this is a good match. You know, most voters across the spectrum are deeply skeptical of Donald Trump. The recent UNH poll showed fully 69% of likely Republican primary voters hold a negative opinion of Donald Trump. So, you know, there's plenty of room for improvement there. Trump is, he said he's never been more serious. We'll see. Everyone I've talked to is deeply skeptical. But if he's hiring people and if he mounts a campaign, you know, it'll be entertaining to cover.
Kevin, I think he said this time is different, but I think he has said in years past that time was different as well.
He did, and he's entertained all kinds of opportunities on the electoral side. He thought about running for New York governor in the last year and a half, passed on that. I'm with Josh. I'll believe it when I see it, certainly, but I'll also indicate that working for a new media company it wouldn't bother us at all if Donald Trump is in this race, since we know his checks are good and he says he's going to self-fund this campaign if there is a campaign. The other thing about Donald Trump we already know very well is he really doesn't care what other people think about him. I mean, he will not – I don't think he'll be cowed out of this race by the kind of poll numbers that Josh alluded to. A lot of people would in this game, basically would look at the long odds and look at the skeptics that are out there because of the many colorful things that Donald Trump has said and will say. I wish Corey Lewandowski the best of luck. This is a guy who has no filter at all. He's capable of saying anything at any time. And that's what he'll make this race much more entertaining if he's in it.
That's putting it mildly, I would say. Now, less covered, Josh, but no less interesting, is a particular visit that a potential candidate made this week to New Hampshire, the former governor of Maryland, Bob Ehrlich. And he had a very unusual interaction with some of the students that he met with while he was in the state.
You know, I wasn't at this event, but it was described as a sort of Socratic town hall style meeting that he held at New England College, where he went around the room and asked students questions. You know, there are a number of people who were once governors in states that, but not governors recently, who have been up here indicating that they're looking at running, in addition to Bob Ehrlich, who lost after one term. We have George Pataki, who's, you know, like Donald Trump, has made noises about running in the past and then, you know, not followed through. We have Jim Gilmore, who I guess he did briefly run in 2008, most remembered for the coinage of Rudy McRomney. You know, all of these fellows, it's unclear exactly what they're thinking. Obviously, you know, American politics is open to everybody and these people have been elected to statewide office, but you know, how much of a groundswell of support they're going to be for any folks who have been out of it for so long and aren't galvanizing excitement remains to be seen. But yes, you know, add Bob Ehrlich's name to the list of, you know, 20 odd people who have been making noises like they could seek the Republican nomination.
And some of the more prominent names on that list are going to be coming into the state over the next few weeks. I think I saw Jeb Bush's name in an event with Frank Ginta, and Rand Paul is the Kentucky U.S. Senator is set to come back to the state in a few weeks, and Marco Rubio, I think, is coming back again as well.
Yeah, Ted Cruz too, any number of folks. I think it reflects a real tension in the Republican Party right now, and that tension really is about a comment that Josh made earlier today. Are we ready to turn the page? And that includes turning the page past a Bush. And I think that's what's going on here, is that a lot of prominent and not so prominent Republicans, and I put former Governor Ehrlich in the latter category, are looking at this campaign and believing that there's going to be a fulcrum of voters who are going to decide, I don't want another Bush as my nominee. I'm looking for somebody else. And that somebody else, we can all agree right now, is very unclear who that person is going to be, where that person is going to come from, what issue is going to catapult them to the front of this pack. So until that becomes a whole lot more clear, we're going to stick with 18, 19, 20, 21 names or so. Will that kind of group, that kind of size group remain through this Columbus Day? No. I don't believe it will. I think it'll sugar down to more like 8 to 10 by the time we're done, and folks like Ehrlich probably and Gilmore will probably fall by the wayside. But until then, they seem to be having a good time, and as we know, activists here and voters here are very welcoming and inviting for anybody who wants to come in.
Well, so more to come on those candidates, I'm sure, as the warmer weather comes, it definitely. But let's turn our attention to a different part of this week's news. It's more statewide political news. There was a series of ads that came out over the last few weeks. Both the National Republican Senatorial Committee and the nonprofit conservative group Crossroads GPS, which is affiliated with former George W. Bush strategist Karl Rove, they both put out ads criticizing Governor Maggie Hassan. We have a sound clip of part of the ad by the National Republican Senatorial Committee accusing Governor Hassan of hiring a chief operating officer, which is in her 2-year budget proposal. But they say the idea behind that job is that it will leave her open to focus on running for the U.S. Senate in 2016. Let's hear some of that.
Do you find your current job too stressful, too burdensome? Have you wanted to find a new job but just can't find the time to look? Be like Governor Maggie Hassan and hire someone to do your job for you. Governor Hassan is hiring a chief operating officer to run New Hampshire while she runs for Senate.
That's a part of an ad from the National Republican Senatorial Committee criticizing Governor Maggie Hassan for what they're saying is a likely 2016 U.S. Senate run challenging Republican incumbent Kelly Ayotte. Josh, we're starting to see more of this discussion, at least in the national level, about this potential matchup next year.
Well, I mean, the discussion has been going on at the state level for some time as well. Governor Hassan has said that, you know, she's focused on running for governor and that we might expect to learn about what she's planning to do next in the summertime. You know, this is of a piece with state party, Republican Party efforts to FOIA her out-of-state travel records. And, you know, Chris Christie, when he was recently here, sort of got into the act as well of saying, you know, this guy, you've got a governor who's using her office as a stepping stone for another office, which, you know, is kind of a pot and kettle situation perhaps. But, you know, this – you know, bespeaks the fact that, you know, you look at the polls, Governor Hassan is pretty popular and would be on paper at least a formidable candidate to run against Kelly Ayotte. NBC had a poll that showed Hassan up slightly. The Ayotte political people have been assuming that Hassan will be running against her for some time and have been doing polling, and this is what they think is going to happen. And, you know, you look at the dynamics in presidential year, Democrats have tended to do pretty well in New Hampshire. And Democrats certainly think if Hillary Clinton runs and is the nominee that there'll be coattails in New Hampshire. And, you know, in that sort of situation, you know, you can understand why Republicans are focused on sort of nicking Governor Hassan as early and often as possible.
And you do see, Kevin, at least those of us who get the email lists directly from the governor's office, do see now that she's putting out statements fairly regularly now on national issues, not necessarily just New Hampshire issues. I think last week I saw a statement about a national issue about either Homeland Security funding or another issue. Yeah.
Yeah, she got into that debate and basically under the radar, if you will, was daring Senator Kelly Ayotte to support a clean Homeland Security funding bill that Josh alluded to earlier today. I really think this reflects nationally. These are two rising women in their party that generate a lot of enthusiasm. Both parties, in some respects, want this race to occur. I think Republicans want it to occur because they feel Kelly Ayotte is their strongest commodity, and they feel Kelly Ayotte, frankly, is the only person that might short-circuit Governor Hassan's career. The Democrats really want this because they fervently believe the only person that could take out Kelly Ayotte is Governor Maggie Hassan. And to Josh's point, Republicans have some work to do. I mean, Governor Hassan did not win re-election by a landslide by any stretch of the imagination, but she emerged with like 70% favorable rating among the voters here. They have to muddy her up, as it were, and that's what these ads are frankly all about. My colleague Paul Steinhauser broke the story that American Crossroads, Karl Rove's super PAC, got into the act at the end of the week with radio ads similar to the sound we just heard. It's important to point out chief operating officer is not an unknown entity in state governments. There are five Republican governors who have chief operating officers, including the governor of Florida, Rick Scott, and Governor Hassan has insisted that's not the objective of this position to allow me to run for Senate. It really was one of the signature recommendations of an innovation commission that she had created to look at all of state government. They basically said, your IT spending is absolutely a mess, that you're on your – now she's nominated fourth IT director in 5 years, purchasing and organization of departments and how they spend money is very haphazard and not organized. You need a chief operating officer to get the reins of that bureaucracy, if you will, and get it to operate more efficiently, it will save money.
I mean, one thing. I mean, as the budget process moves along, that's one of the things that's going to be interesting to watch. Is, you know, last time, of course, you know, we ended up with a budget that was, you know, pretty close to what the Senate Republicans put together, but everyone agreed on it in the end, and Governor Hassan ran hard on we came together, we're in New Hampshire, and we passed a bipartisan budget. You know, for months now, there's been lots of fighting between the governor and Senate Republicans over, you know, management of spending. And, you know, this chief operating officer is you know, highly unlikely to come to pass now that the budget's in the hands of the legislature. But throughout this process, there's going to be I think it's going to be a lot more tense. And the backdrop is going to be, you know, 2016, Republicans, I know, feel they were ill-served by some of the bipartisan actions that took place at the State House. Now, of course, not everybody feels that way, but this is going to be tension throughout. And, you know, to the degree that Republicans are also going hard after Governor Hassan, it also ought to be noted that the Democrats have certainly ratcheted up their efforts to, you know, you would think the press releases come out of their office are pretty much exclusively about Kelly Ayotte these days. And the person they now have is their press guy, the Democratic Party. He was the press guy for Hassan's last campaign. And you know, that's not entirely a coincidence.
So less political incentive, perhaps, then, Kevin, over this next legislative period for the governor and Senate and House Republicans to at least, even if they do wind up agreeing on a budget, which inevitably the governor and legislature wind up doing, that at least they will highlight the differences more than coming together?
Yeah, I think that's true. And P.S., this strategy works. It worked in 2001 and 2002 against then-Governor Jeanne Shaheen, who was clearly running for the U.S. Senate, against Senator Bob Smith, ultimately against Congressman John E. Sununu. The Republican-dominated Executive Council and the House of Representatives made Shaheen's last days as governor a living nightmare, opposed her on every term, stalled all kinds of appointments and contracts, had a very vigorous debate over the budget, and ultimately ended up giving her a budget she didn't like and had to sign.
I mean, one thing that is interesting, when Governor Hassan was on the exchange a couple weeks ago, she said, and I think this is a direct quote, "My job is to propose a balanced budget without a sales or an income tax." I mean, sort of a reductive notion of the job of a governor, but, you know, certainly something that has traditionally made Democrats who take the pledge hard to topple.
We'll have more after a short break. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Brady Carlson. Monday on The Exchange, we'll listen back to our earlier conversation with foreign correspondent HDS Greenway. Today, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, and you can join us by calling in at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. Send an email at exchange@nhpr.org or find us on Twitter or Facebook. We'll turn now to several stories in energy and education this week. And with stories like that, we turn to the reporter who covers these regularly for us, NHPR Sam Evans-Brown. He's here with an update. Hi, Sam.
Hey, thanks, Brady.
This week, a state representative from Brookline wrote to federal regulators urging them to reject the proposal from developer Kinder Morgan to build a natural gas pipeline in parts of southern New Hampshire. The catch with this story, of course, is that that representative happens to be Jack Flanagan, the House Majority Leader.
Right, exactly. I mean, what's interesting here is that normally you do see reps who are along the route of a proposed energy project. They tend to be the first to stand up and say, we are in opposition to this project. He, of course, is one of those folks. But also you tend to see leadership, you know, they tread a little more carefully. They try to take kind of the longer view, and they're hearing more from both sides. They tend to be a little less concerned about re-election from their constituents, a little more concerned about staying in their leadership position by taking that longer view. But he is the first sort of major politician. He's the House Majority Leader to take a stand against the Northeast Energy Direct Pipeline. And what's interesting here is that this is the first indication that there are really two proposals, right, that are being floated. The Northeast Energy Direct would go through southern New Hampshire. It's proposed by Kinder Morgan. And then you have Spectra, Eversource Energy, and National Grid proposing another project that would just expand existing pipelines pipelines in Massachusetts. And you have Jack Flanagan in his letter saying he would prefer that that be the route that, that New England go to.
The Massachusetts route.
Right, to bring more natural gas into New England. And you know, this prompts a question, which is, are these two projects competing? And you talk to the developers and they say, oh, no, no. Even if the other one is built, we'll still build ours. We're not in competition. But, you know, there are hints that they really are angling for the same customers. And certainly politicians will use the fact that there is another project to their advantage to say, no, no, I'm not against expanding natural gas. I just want this other project.
So other than bringing some additional scrutiny to the opposition to the Kinder Morgan proposal, is the fact that the House Majority Leader in New Hampshire coming out against this proposal going to sway the decision much one way or the other?
Certainly the process itself, it will be not a huge change. I mean, if you look at the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission is the federal agency that makes this decision. The opposition of one of 400 New Hampshire representatives is not going to be a big game changer. What it might signal, though, is that you'd see sort of a swell, a groundswell from other New Hampshire politicians. And if you get enough of them, perhaps that would make a difference. But, you know, it's really too early to say whether or not that kind of thing is going to happen.
Okay. And now turning toward education, you had a report this week, Sam, talking about the college graduation rates in New Hampshire, which looked pretty good compared to other states, with one big caveat.
Right. The big caveat, of course, about 80% of students in New Hampshire public universities are graduating. That's the second highest rate in the country. That's quite good, of course. The big caveat is that if you're a part-time student, that rate drops to about 15%, which is below the national average. And of course, non-traditional students, ones who are entering after the age of 24, it's about 45%, which is also below the national average. And this sort of mirrors how New Hampshire does in high school. We have very good high school graduation rates, but of course, for low-income students, they're not as good. And people tend to say, well, the reason that we have such good rates is that we just have fewer low-income students than other states. This report really doesn't point to causality. We can't say whether this is just a demographic question or if our schools are really doing a great job. It's just putting the data out there.
Lots to keep an eye on then. NHPR Sam Evans Brown, thanks so much.
Thank you.
That's New Hampshire Public Radio's Sam Evans Brown, who reports on energy, environment, and education. This is the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Brady Carlson. With us for the hour, Kevin Landergan, Chief Political Correspondent for New Hampshire One News, and Josh Rogers, NHPR Senior Political Reporter. And joining us now is Rick Stevens, who is the Northern New England Correspondent for the Associated Press. He reported this week on the state's roads and highways, and he found a lag in federal funding that may be costing the state a significant amount of money. Rick, great to have you.
Good morning, Brady.
So to be clear, is there less federal money coming into the state's highway trust fund now, or is the money simply coming into the state more slowly?
It's coming into the state more slowly, Brady. The Associated Press took a national look at this issue in all 50 states, as well as the overview story, and found that in all but two states, the rate of growth has fallen. Only Alaska and New York have experienced growth in the Federal Highway Trust Fund money coming into those states. So what that has meant is that these other 48 states have had to make up the balance somewhere by using all sorts of unique ways. And the end result, you and I feel it every day as we're driving over the roads and bridges in our state. We have the State Department of Transportation uses what's called a ride comfort index, which basically means how smooth is your ride, to and from work, to and from the kids' school. And they find that more than a third of the roads are really going to jar your teeth loose. They're very, very chopped up. 1,600 miles worth of roads in the state are rated as poor. That's out of a total of about 4,800 in the state. So there's a real, there's a real street level cost to this. Drivers pay about an average of $350 or so a year just to maintain their cars as a result of these chewed up roads, with front end alignments and blown tires and the rest of it.
And I believe the State Department of Transportation officials were arguing that because the money is coming in more slowly, it actually winds up costing more to repair a road or to fix up a bridge because you're sometimes doing the same work multiple times as winters come and go and things like that.
That's right. Deputy Transportation Commissioner Patrick McKenna put it in a really understandable way for me when I interviewed him for the story. Think of your driveway at home, and if you've got a paved driveway, you know, a blacktop driveway, and every couple of years, as they recommend, you seal coat it and you fill the cracks and you pull the weeds out of the middle of the driveway, you keep that driveway in good shape for a number of years at a relatively inexpensive cost. But if you don't seal coat it, if you let it go and those cracks get bigger, water gets in, and this is the same way on New Hampshire's roads and roads everywhere, particularly in the colder climates like we live in. Water gets into those cracks, seeps into the bedding of the road, and then you get that frost, the freeze and thaw cycle that creates the huge frost heaves and the potholes. And pretty soon, and it doesn't take long, the road is destroyed. It's into that, quote, poor category on the comfort index, and it's got to be replaced. So instead of, McKenna tells me that instead of maintaining these roads, and it really is the smaller connector roads that we're talking about, you know, I-93 and the turnpikes and 89, they, for good reason, they get a good share of the attention. But on those connector roads, if you're not doing the maintenance every 7 to 9 years at a cost of, it can range from $50,000 to $100,000 a mile, you don't do it every 7 to 9 years, now you've got to reconstruct that roadway, and that cost can increase by 10 or 20 times. So you're talking about a huge difference in the amount of money that you spend on roads.
And finally, what are lawmakers saying about this news?
Well, you know, Chuck Morse, he's a Republican, the Senate president from Salem, and he understands. He sees the roads. He drives the roads. But he says the state has to make tough choices. They're doing the best they can with the limited amount of funding that they do have. They've done things like raise the fuel tax 4 cents a gallon last year. That brought in or brings in some $32 million a year, solely dedicated for roads and bridges. It can't get diverted. They also they've borrowed hundreds of millions to do things like complete the I-93 expansion. There are other options out there that other states are taking. People are looking at using retail sales taxes or mileage taxes or tolls to kind of fill in the gap that the federal funding has left.
And then, of course, we're still waiting for all the snow to melt to really see what all of the roads are going to look like when all is said and done. Rick Stevens, thanks so much for your time today. Great talking with you.
Thanks for having me.
That's Rick Stevens, Northern New England correspondent for the Associated Press. With us for the hour on the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup is Kevin Landergan, chief political correspondent for New Hampshire One News, and Josh Rogers, an HBR senior political reporter. Even though, Kevin, it was school vacation week for a lot of New Hampshire families, there was actually quite a bit of news going on, and one big story that came to a resolution this week was with Fairpoint Communications. A four-month-long strike, 6 weeks of closed-door negotiations led by a federal mediator, and over the weekend, all of a sudden, a deal in place, it's ratified, and now the workers are back on the job.
Yeah, it's certainly good news for Governor Maggie Hassan and the legislature and the state of New Hampshire, frankly. I think the hard work begins now. There's a fairly decent backlog of in-service calls that collected while Fairpoint was out on strike. The union folks insist that the contractors that Fairpoint hired weren't as efficient and weren't as effective as they were in treating a lot of these activities. I do think this was an example of where the political infrastructure, if you will, actually helped bring about an agreement. Usually politicians, when a strike happens, you feel bad, you express concern for the strikers who are going without paychecks and health insurance through the holiday period, I might add. But there isn't a whole lot you can do. I think this governor kept the pressure on. I think the Republican Majority Executive Council kept the pressure on, had Fairpoint executives at the meeting table a couple of times, got from them commitments to hold public meetings, if you will, in every council district to address the hundreds of people that had called, emailed,
And even briefly held off on approving a contract with the company.
Exactly. Stalled a contract for Fairpoint to continue to be the primary telecommunications company for the state of New Hampshire. A $13 million contract through 2020, a significant chunk of business, includes some upgrades to Wi-Fi and the hardline system that they manage for the state of New Hampshire. So there was a real desire to get that done. But a pretty good example from what we know of the details and of where both sides really gave in. And I think the mediator played a big part in this. The union ended up making concessions they were not about to make before the beginning of the strike. Management gave away some things for the same purposes. We're not giving you that at the table until we went through this very protracted and very difficult impasse.
The comments that both sides were making afterwards was, this is not a contract anybody's particularly happy with, but at least if there's going to be some give, that there's give on both sides.
Yeah, big change in the pension area, for example, for employees. We go from what was a defined benefit pension, which state employees now receive, and that increasingly in the public sector is becoming less and less common. We go now to, for these employees, a 401k situation where the company makes makes contributions towards an investment account, if you will, that the employee has to manage. That's a whole different story than a specific end of the rainbow pension I know I'm going to get no matter what happens with the economy or with Wall Street.
Also this week, Josh, we got new details on the data hack at Anthem. This is a nationwide hack, tens of millions of people affected, but we got some new details about what happened here in the state, and the numbers are roughly half of New Hampshire's population.
Yes, close to 700,000 people, and interestingly, reaching all the way back to 2004, which you know, that's a lot of people. You know, this is 79 million people nationwide. So, you know, not good. I mean, the indications are that so far no credit card information or confidential health information was taken. But, you know, who knows? Obviously a very large breach.
But just the sheer size of that being roughly half of New Hampshire's population, does that say anything particularly about the state of insurance as it's been in the last 10 years in this state?
Well, I mean, I think it certainly says that there haven't been many carriers, and a lot of them have been with Anthem and, you know, to a lesser extent, Harvard Pilgrim. They've been the two big insurers.
Yeah, I think the biggest point here is that if Anthem wasn't the dominant insurer that it is in New Hampshire, this company would be in trouble in New Hampshire. They'd be hemorrhaging customers. To Josh's point, in large swaths of the state, they're almost the only game in town. And they've stepped up their damage control operation with regard to this hack. They're much more affirmative than they were at the beginning. They're now out there sending emails to all these affected folks. They're offering 2 years of identity fraud protection to employees. They've brought on Colin Manning now as a communications director in New Hampshire, former press secretary, to New Hampshire governor, a former colleague of ours in the State House press room, very savvy guy, comes from Harvard University where he was before, should help them frame their message because they've got some work to do in the marketing department right now.
And officials in a number of states, Josh, have suggested maybe there should be a broader investigation, and it's we don't know yet whether New Hampshire might be a part if there is such an investigation.
Has there been talk yet?
This
is a massive, massive problem.
Well, finally, this week, we got a little bit of literary news, Kevin. The New Hampshire Writers Project teaming up with Southern New Hampshire University to form the New Hampshire Literary Hall of Fame, and some big names in their inaugural class. We've got Robert Frost is the one they said everybody agreed on. And then some other big names on top of that. Grace Metalius, the author of Peyton Place. And
novelist. Two guys are still alive, too.
And two guys are still alive,
right,
too. Donald Paul and John Irving, the novelist. So a new wrinkle in New Hampshire's literary caps.
Yeah, it's pretty neat. And it was a pretty good group, pretty good committee that came up with these names, including an NHPR stalwart. I think it sort of speaks to, for a very small state, we have some real literary giants. There are all kinds of folks, you know, very good authors that aren't on this list, certainly Dan Brown, Jody Picoult, the list is long, but nobody can argue with the four that they've come up with. They're really impressive.
They said there were something like 12,000 published authors in New Hampshire dating back to colonial times. They're going to pick two every 2 years, so some folks may be on the waiting list for a while. Before we wrap up, I'll just ask what news stories each of you is going to be paying attention to in the coming week. Josh, I'll start with you.
Well, so school vacation week means that the legislature's been on session this week. They're going to be back in town next week, and there'll be a fair amount of action. They're, you know, sort of a backup of bills, and so we'll see what emerges from the under the dome.
And Kevin?
Well, certainly the parade continues. You know, Rob Portman's coming in the state. I'm always interested in people who say no. Rob Portman decided I'm not running for president. Certainly was on the short list of people on the running mate list. Carly Fiorina, someone who may say yes, is coming back into the state. So we'll be spending time with her as well.
All right. Well, a big thank you to both of you for coming in for today's News Roundup. Kevin Landergan, thanks so much.
Thanks, Brady.
That's Kevin Landergan, chief political correspondent for New Hampshire One News. And Josh Rogers, great to talk with you as well.
You're welcome, Brady.
That's Josh Rogers, NHPR senior political reporter. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producers are Faith Meixel and Josh Moon. The executive senior producer of The Exchange is Ellen Grimm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Brady Carlson in for Laura Kanoy.